We need a new system. We need a new society. We need to demand that which may have sounded impossible even a few weeks ago, but is not only realizable, but an imperative necessity. Donald Trump is sending the U.S. military to the cities of the United States to wage what he calls a war within. Welcome to the Socialist Program. I'm your host, Brian Becker. Today, we're talking with Mike Preisner. Mike is a veteran, an anti-war organizer, and he is the producer of the Empire Files' new film called The Earth's Greatest Enemy, about the environmental impact of the U.S. military. Okay, I'm going to start from the beginning all the way around because this is just too many words. And I said the Earths instead of Earths. Earths. Okay, here we go. Donald Trump is sending the U.S. military to wage a war within the United States. He's deploying the U.S. military to cities and towns inside of the country. Welcome to this week's episode of The Real Story on the Socialist Program. I'm your host, Brian Becker. Today, we're talking with Mike Preisner. Mike is a military veteran. He's an anti-war organizer. He's a producer of The Empire Files, which is premiering a new film called Earth's Greatest Enemy about the environmental impact of the U.S. military. It comes out this month, and it's in cities around the United States. Find a screening at earthsgreatestenemy.com. Mike Preisner, welcome back.
Hi, Brian.
I wanted to talk to you about the executive order signed by Donald Trump last week, deploying the federal military to, quote, crush violent radical left terrorism in Portland, Oregon. I thought, okay, Mike Preisner, you're in Portland. Let's talk to you about what's going on in Portland. But then there was that meeting on Tuesday with Pete Hegseth and Donald Trump and hundreds of U.S. generals brought together on short notice from all over the country, I mean, all over the world. I want to talk to you about that meeting, what its significance is. Before we get your comments, I want to start with a clip. It's Donald Trump explaining a little bit to the assembled crowd of generals what he wants to talk about.
Last month, I signed an executive order to provide training for a quick reaction force that can help quell civil disturbances. This is going to be a big thing for the people in this room because it's the enemy from within, and we have to handle it before it gets out of control. It won't get out of control.
That sounds ominous. It sounds ominous to democracy. Anyway, Mike Preisner, your thoughts?
Yeah, well, of course, the deployments of the Guard and this unprecedented meeting of generals that were summoned from around the world are, of course, very linked. The deployment of the Guard around the country. I mean, you know, here in Portland, I think from normal Portlanders, people who live here, people who aren't into politics, I mean, they see this as really a joke. You know, when Trump describes Portland as hell on earth and a war zone, I think the most common thing you'll find is Portlanders celebrating their city and how nice and beautiful it is. This is a really great place. And so this doesn't resonate with people who actually live here, much like the rationale about the Guard needing to be in D.C. and things like that, who found themselves with nothing to do. I think that the biggest and most disturbing part of this that service members and, of course, Americans in general should be aware of is, of course, this is a measure to increase the authoritarian rule of the right. And I think that these testing grounds of using Los Angeles against the protests in D.C., the deployment of the Guard, I mean, this is just, you know, steps towards an increasing police state. And in particular, what they have been doing is mainly providing support for ICE, which Trump is really building up as his own personal paramilitary. I mean, people who are, I would say, the worst of the worst in the police forces, like the true ideologues that clearly have no concern with constitutional rights or democratic rights, but want to carry out a viciously anti-immigrant agenda and relish and celebrate that viciously anti-immigrant agenda. And so those are of course, wearing masks and putting out propaganda videos that are really shocking, still shocking, as wild as they get. And so this, I think, is the main, you know, the main reason for them. It's not to stop crime. It's not to, you know, end the war zone that is Portland. I mean, these are very, you know, specific steps towards increasing authoritarianism from the Trump administration and the right wing as a whole, which sees itself as having been persecuted for so many years by the liberal establishment in media and in culture and in politics. And I also do think that I think it's very important for the Guard people that are being deployed also to recognize that, you know, this is very much a distraction propaganda from the Epstein scandal. I mean, if we really think back to when the National Guard deployment started, it was as the walls were closing in around Trump for the really bombshell evidence coming out against him that he was not only a friend of Epstein, but a close friend and possibly more deeply involved in his trafficking operation than previously thought. And so, you know, you had people like Kash Patel and Bagingo, who really built careers off talking about Epstein specifically. People like Tulsi Gabbard as head of the DNI, who really built her brand around protecting young girls. You had them scrambling to put out stories and drops and Obama files and all these things that would try to soak up some amount of media attention to take the focus away from these bombshell Epstein stories that were coming out every few days that were very, very damning for Trump. And so, you know, ultimately, in addition to this very scary role of increasing the tyrannical power of the Trump administration that, you know, his speech to the generals really illustrates, you know, how far he wants to take that. You also have Guard soldiers having to understand that they are very much just being props to distract away from an Epstein associate who happens to be our president.
So there's different pieces to this, Mike. There's the distraction from the Epstein scandal and Trump's possible, well, not possible, Trump's obvious links to Epstein. And then there is the militarization of U.S. society, the normalizing of the deployment of U.S. military forces against people in the United States. And Trump, when he spoke before, along with Hegseth, before these generals, these assembled group of generals, he makes it quite clear that he intends to use the U.S. military against the people of the United States and as part of a global war. He says this is the war from within, but the cities and towns of the United States can be the training grounds for the U.S. military. I mean, people who think they live in a democracy actually have to pay attention to this. I want to play another clip from Trump and then go back to you.
I told Pete we should use some of these dangerous cities as training grounds for our military, National Guard, but military. Because we're going into Chicago versus ones that are run by the radical left Democrats, what they've done to San Francisco, Chicago, New York, Los Angeles. They're very unsafe places, and we're going to straighten them out one by one. And this is going to be a major part for some of the people in this room. That's a war, too. It's a war from within. Controlling the physical territory of our border is essential to national security.
I mean, Mike, this is antithetical to the notion that the civilian government rules over the military, that the military is to defend the country. Trump is making the argument that the enemy, the danger to the people of the United States is from within the country, from radical left Democrats. I mean, that whole notion is so absurd. The Democratic Party is obviously a ruling class party. In Europe, it would be a center right party, not a radical left extremist party. But again, going back to the executive order about Portland and the deployment of military forces there, it says in Trump's language, the radical left's reign of terror in Portland ends now with President Donald J. Trump mobilizing military forces to stop Antifa-led hellfire in its tracks. Mm-hmm. I mean, the language is off the charts. Anyway, I want to ask you about one, what's it actually like in Portland? You alluded to it, but you said most people in Portland think this is a joke. But there is no Antifa. There's like not an Antifa headquarters. They're not sitting around the Antifa headquarters like dissecting Trump's executive order. But then it is ominous because whatever the pretext is and the false rhetoric, it's being used to paint a picture, especially for people maybe outside the cities of these the named cities, that the country really is erupting in this reign of terror. And the only thing that can bring it under control is the deployment of the U.S. military. One, again, how do you feel about that, or how do you think the country's going to feel about it? How is the U.S. military, how are the rank and file members of the armed forces going to look at this? Because obviously they have to know it's BS.
Sure. Well, there's a couple of pieces to this. I mean, the one is just the spectacle of it. And so much of Trump's administration, you can look at the wide swath of things that he has done with executive orders, with statements and things like that. So much of it is just throwing red meat to right wingers who are online way too much, like extremely online, older white Americans. And it's really just kind of like taking the memes that are popular in online right wing world and saying that you're going to address them. And so Portland has had, you know, especially since the 2020 uprisings, had a reputation of being this hellscape Antifa run city. And this exists really just in right wing social media. And so this, him singling out Portland as one of the first cities that he wants to deploy the military to, this is just to satisfy this like ultra online right wing desire. You know, it's very similar to D.C., where this has long been a right wing fantasy. You know, D.C., a black run city, that D.C. is a place that needs to be taken over by the good old boys again. And so he's addressing things that are very popular in the right wing consciousness, both historically and in the ultra online space. And so, of course, there's really no need for them. You know, even if you look at the perspective of the right wing, because that's why in D.C. the Guard has found itself with really nothing to do except, you know, raking some leaves and picking up some trash. Here in Portland, yes, there are, you know, anarchist, I guess you could call it, led protests against the ICE facility, but these are pretty small demonstrations, right? I mean, I think that the police forces outnumber the protesters at least 100-1, but probably 1,000-1 or more at these things. So if the Guard comes, I mean, that's what else are they going to offer? And the military forces here in ICE, I'm sorry, the police forces in ICE here are way more equipped to even deal with them than the National Guard is. And so these are, of course, symbolic things, both for propaganda purposes, but also to normalize this thing that is happening, to normalize the use of American soldiers on the streets of the U.S. And of course, you know, when Trump is talking about the enemy within, which is really, you know, Hitler speak, you know, he's talking about immigrants and our immigrant neighbors, which are, of course, a huge part of the fabric of our society here and, you know, beloved in our cities. But also the fact that he's singling out the left as the internal enemy, I think, is quite concerning because of the real, you know, the implications of that, using the military to crush the political enemies of the president. And so I think that within the military, there is, I mean, I have my own contacts that speak to this, but I think what's more telling is that the general of the Oregon National Guard, the commander of the Oregon National Guard, actually sent out a letter to all the 200 soldiers that are being mobilized for Portland. And basically his letter is saying, I know you all think this is BS. I know most of you disagree with this, but we have to remember we have a job to do and we have a reputation to maintain. And so it doesn't have to come from me. It's coming from the commander of the soldiers. They are well aware that this is unpopular within the ranks of the military. And I think there's it's very much linked to Hegseth's reforms that he talked about at his speech at Quantico. It's as they are increasing the authoritarian type control and mechanisms of the U.S. military, they are also trying to carry out a purge in a lot of ways of people that may be opposed to those things internally. And that's what a lot of the reforms and things that Hegseth spoke about at Quantico, I think, are addressing. And so they're telling soldiers, we know you probably disagree with this, just keep your head down, while at the same time finding ways to get rid of people who may disagree.
Well, let's play a couple of clips from Hegseth's speech, too, because, you know, Hegseth wrote a book in 2024 called A War on Warriors. It was kind of him auditioning for a potential post in the Trump administration, should Trump have won, and he did win the 2024 election. But it's very interesting, you know, there was a lot of talk in the media, why has Hegseth and Trump brought all of these military leaders together? And it's a great expense, and it's at the last minute, and it's a logistical nightmare, and it makes America less safe because all of these key people are brought together into one room where they're vulnerable. I mean, all of this kind of weird nonsense from the non-Trump sort of ruling class media about why this is Trump against the generals. And then there was a lot of talk about how the generals didn't look like they were laughing and smiling that much, and then maybe they were even
like that.
Maybe they were even scowling. I mean, very vapid. I want to play what a couple of clips from Hegseth. We'll start with one, and then I'll get your reaction. But I don't think the generals are necessarily disagreeing with Hegseth and Trump at all. Anyway, let's listen first to Pete Hegseth, Secretary of War.
We fight to win. We unleash overwhelming and punishing violence on the enemy. We also don't fight with stupid rules of engagement. We untie the hands of our warfighters to intimidate, demoralize, hunt, and kill the enemies of our country.
Well, let's just talk about the rules of engagement. What is he talking about there?
Well, he's talking about the Geneva Conventions and international law, which I guess are a huge barrier to the U.S. and is the reason we lost the war in Iraq and lost the war in Afghanistan and lost the war in Vietnam, even though Geneva Convention was, I would say, probably not followed to a high degree in those wars either. You know, this isn't the first time we've heard this kind of rhetoric. Trump, you know, recently has talked about how, you know, there's so many wars we could have won had we not been restrained. And what he's really talking about is applying the Gaza model to U.S. wars, of applying just complete destruction of all cities and infrastructure, starvation siege and those types of practices. And so they're looking at Israel and Gaza and saying, oh, man, like they don't have to worry about these restrictions and these rules of engagement. You know, and this whole time we've been embarrassed overseas because we've been being politically correct, as Hegseth called it later in his speech about how we decide to kill people. So, you know, this is something that Trump did during his first term. He already, you know, loosened restrictions on the type of bombing that the military could do, things that once required White House authorization. He said, you don't need my authorization. You're free to do whatever you want. And so there really was a pickup of this kind of thing. That's why you saw like a huge surge in civilian casualties under the first Trump administration. So this is something they've been talking about and actually implementing for a while. But the fact that Hegseth saying it in front of the room of the entire military command, saying, you know, you are not going to get in trouble anymore for doing anything that otherwise would have been considered illegal.
Racism, racist abuse of black soldiers and other soldiers of color, that's been a long-standing issue in the U.S. military. During the Vietnam War, there were many, many rebellions led by black soldiers against the war, but also against racism in the military. Until 1948, the U.S. military was completely segregated. And then there became sort of in the last 20, 25 years, the idea that the military really was an equal opportunity employer, that if you were hardworking, if you were, you know, disciplined, if you were took your job seriously, regardless of whether you were black or white or Latino or Asian American or Native or whatever, that you could climb the ladder, that there was like a changed culture within the Pentagon. Now, you know, and you and I have talked, and we've talked on this show before about the extreme racism that's been directed against the targets of American imperialism. I mean, the people in Iraq, the people in Afghanistan, the racist caricaturing of people who were occupied and just terribly mistreated, killed en masse. Racism is always there. You can't really talk about the U.S. military and not talk about racism. But Hegseth and the Republicans and Trump, they're acting like the Pentagon is this woke, anti-racist organization, and now it has to stop. There has to be a cultural sort of shift away from any remedy of racism or sexism. Anyway, that was, it seemed to be a big theme in Hegseth's speech yesterday.
Yeah, well, I think one of the most significant reforms that he's put out is what is ostensibly a purge of black servicemen from all branches of the armed forces. You know, it's important to recognize that the struggle for African-American rights in the military expands almost the entire history of the U.S. military. It was in the Civil War era that that black men fought for the right to join the army, which didn't allow black people in the military in order to fight against the Confederacy. In the 40s, the struggle to desegregate the military was, you know, perhaps the beginning of the modern civil rights movement, and the desegregation of the military went on to inform and spearhead the struggle to desegregate education in this country. And then after the desegregation of the military, there has been long struggles against discrimination and racism in the military. Of course, the Vietnam era being very emblematic, where the casualty rates for black men were off the charts. And so one of the ways that, you know, there's been a progress that has been made, you know, within this sphere, because, you know, like reforms under Obama with trans people and gay people serving in the military, the Pentagon has to adapt to American society in order to remain a legitimate entity in the eyes of Americans and to recruit people and things like that. But Hegseth is very much of the view, and the right wingers like him, that this is holding back the military and they want to reverse it. But I think one of the significant things that he has put forward is this grooming standards thing, which I think most Americans may not seem like it's much that, oh, you shouldn't be able to have a beard when you're in the military. But in the U.S. military, there is a, you know, there's a skin condition that black servicemen deal with, where because you have to be clean shaven all the time. Upwards of 83% of black men deal with a condition that makes it difficult for them to do close shaves. And so in the military currently, you can get what's called a shaving profile, which means you don't have to do a close shave. And even when I was in, I mean, this is in the early 2000s, this was people with a shaving profile. It was used as a way to denigrate black soldiers. You know, if you had a shaving profile, it's because you were a slacker, you were a malingerer. It would make it harder for you to get promoted. And I think it was it always had this negative stigma in the military from white service members and in particular white leaders. But, you know, it's you can have that skin condition and be in the military. Hegseth is saying if you have that skin condition, you can no longer be in the military. And so what Hegseth is saying is that upwards of 83% of black servicemen in all branches of the military can be discharged within in a year, are going to be kicked out of the military. And I don't think it's any coincidence that they are implementing this measure to do really a mass purge of black servicemen. At the same time, they are saying they want the U.S. military to go into majority black cities or going to black cities and occupy them. And so, you know, this idea of trying to get rid of the people that may disagree with what you're doing, I don't see any clearer example than this.
Well, let's play another clip by Hegseth. He talks about to end the war on warriors. Again, he wrote a book called The War on Warriors in 2024. It came out. Listen to this clip because, again, we need to parse the words, especially for people who are not familiar with some of the issues within the military, to show exactly how racist and how sexist some of the demands Hegseth is putting forward and insisting on, as evidenced in this speech.
We are clearing out the debris, removing the distractions, clearing the way for leaders to be leaders. You might say we're ending the war on warriors. I heard someone wrote a book about that. For too long, we've promoted too many uniformed leaders for the wrong reasons, based on their race, based on gender quotas, based on historic so-called firsts.
Mike, this is the Make America Great Again, Make America Even More White Supremacist Again, going back to where we were as a country before the Civil Rights Revolution created such a major, not only legislative and political and economic shift, but a cultural shift. America had something of a cultural revolution as a consequence of the great Civil Rights Revolution, especially 1955 with the Montgomery bus boycott to 1970. But as you pointed out, much of this movement for civil rights was started by black soldiers, returning veterans after World War II, who made the argument, we're not going to be first-class soldiers and second-class citizens. And so black soldiers came back and started demanding their rights, especially in the South, where Jim Crow racism ruled the roost. This is what Hegseth and the MAGA military leadership, or the MAGA political leadership inside the military, is trying to accomplish. This has to be a point of great resistance. I mean, we're no fan, neither you or I are fan of the U.S. military, but the effort to roll back every achievement, every civil rights reform, every remedy to past racism and discrimination inside the U.S. military is a signal about how far they actually want to go. Because for the last 20 or 30 years, the U.S. has said to the world, see, you can... We've overcome racism. See, we had a problem earlier with all of that apartheid and slavery, but we, the Pentagon, have overcome it by having some remedy to racism. And now the political leadership of the ultra-right says, like, no, we're going back. We're going to wipe out all of the achievements of the civil rights movement.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, what these people think the U.S. military should look like is the, like, special operator online archetype. You know, if you look at the Joint Special Operations Command, like the elite of the special forces in the U.S. military, JSOC, it's like 99% white, roided out dudes with beards. And that's kind of what they think the entire U.S. military should look like, is these hardcore white killers. And so this kind of aesthetic of the military, like, that's how they see it. And so it's very much, yes, based on this kind of racist, like, white supremacist fantasy of what the American military should look like. But it is also about removing that internal opposition. Like, Hegseth had already come in and fired several leading women and black generals, including the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, saying that they were, quote, DEI hires. And they even removed commemorations on the Army website to, like, Black Medal of Honor winners, and change the URL to DEI Medal of Honor and things like that. And so I think it's very clearly about both rolling back that cultural revolution that you mentioned, but rolling back any form of internal opposition that they might deal with, which I don't personally think would have come from the chairman of the Joint Chiefs or, you know, any of those other people that he fired. It's very much about, you know, kind of taking control of that institution as they kind of push the limits of what they intend to use it for. And, you know, when Hegseth talks about ending the war on warriors, I mean, part of it is this rollback of DEI, but I think another significant part of his speech, when he mentioned what constituted the war on warriors, he specifically talked about the ability of service members, in particular women, to report sexual assault on their units, which has been a rampant problem, which some reforms have been made over the past few years because of service members fighting back. But I think that was a very disturbing and worrying change that he's making for the military now.
Well, let's play another clip. It's where he talks about, this is Hegseth, Secretary of War, talking about getting rid of anonymous complaints. I want to play the clip and then have you explain it to our audience.
We are overhauling an inspector general process, the IG, that has been weaponized, putting complainers, ideologues, and poor performers in the driver's seat. We're doing the same with the equal opportunity and military equal opportunity policies, the EO and MEO at our department. No more frivolous complaints, no more anonymous complaints, no more repeat complainants, no more smearing reputations, no more endless waiting, no more legal limbo, no more sidetracking careers, no more walking on eggshells.
No more walking on eggshells. So if you get accused of sexual abuse, sexual misconduct, which Hegseth himself has been accused of, and almost or seemed to possibly make it impossible for him to be confirmed, but the right wing overcame that with the help of the Democrats. That's what he's talking about. Anonymous complaints and complainers and you know, regular complainants and people walking on eggshells. The people he's talking about are men who are accused of sexual abuse.
Yeah, you know, he wasn't just accused, but I think he paid someone a lot of money to settle a sexual assault claim. But, you know, when he mentions anonymous complaints, to those who don't know how things work in the military, you know, if you're sexually assaulted in the military, a lot of times, most times, that's from somebody in your unit or someone who outranks you in your unit. And so when you're not able to anonymously report a sexual assault, that means you have to report a sexual assault, and then everyone in your unit knows that you did it, and the person who outranks you knows you did it, and they don't immediately get in trouble. It begins a process and investigation where then you still have to serve in this unit functioning under this person who knows that you have made this accusation against him, or, you know, who committed this crime and knows that you're going after them for it. And so that, of course, prevents so many people and has prevented so many people from coming forward with rape and sexual assault reports. This was a massive problem, and still is, but historically has been a massive problem in the military, and something that, you know, men are sexually assaulted in the military as well by other men to a larger degree than they are in the general population. The same is true for women. They are sexually assaulted in the military at a higher rate than they are in the general population. But it was women in particular who really fought to make this issue well known throughout the military because it was so rampant. And it wasn't just rampant in garrison, but it was rampant on deployments. And I think one of the big things that broke this into the mainstream and made it a real scandal for U.S. commanders was the fact that women who were in Iraq, deployed to Iraq, were so fearful of sexual assault and rape by their fellow service members that they would carry, you know, weapons around on base. Like, you will hear testimony of women who carried a knife on them specifically for if, when they are walking to the bathroom, they were being sexually assaulted by another soldier, they could defend themselves and stab them. You had reports, a whistleblower who came out and alleged that there were several deaths of women soldiers that were covered up because they died of dehydration because they were scared to drink too much water in the evening so they wouldn't have to go to the bathroom alone at night. And of course, died of dehydration because of the extreme heat. And so that kind of helped break the story out into the mainstream. When that story broke out, so many women who had served in Iraq or who were just in the military came out about how difficult it was to report sexual assault. Not only was it rampant, but you could not report it. You could not get anyone in trouble for it. You had to stay serving under your abuser. And so the Pentagon, because they had to, because they were embarrassed in the media and it had become a big scandal for them, they did start to implement measures that made it easier to report rape and sexual assault. And making those complaints anonymously was one of the ways that they made it easier for people to do so, to address a very real and rampant problem in the military. And so Hegseth saying, we're going to go back on that, it just means that more people will be subject to sexual assault and more people will be scared to report sexual assault. That will be the real consequence of it.
Yeah, I mean, and this is such a rampant problem. And I want to just spend another minute or two. There's the Telehook scandal from 1991, 83 women and a few men, as you mentioned, also, you know, subject to extreme sexual abuse, misconduct, rape, and while they were at a Navy, this was abuse by Marine and Naval commanders, including senior people, at a hotel, a Hilton hotel in Las Vegas, at the Telehook annual conference. But it's not just at the conferences, it's everywhere. And the power situation in the military, Mike, and just, again, I want to spend a little bit more time on this for people who have never been in the military. You're part of a chain of command. It's not like you're out in society. You have people who have direct authority over you 24 hours a day. They have the ability to give you orders, commands. You have to obey them. Or you're, you know, I want to talk to you because you have defended so many people about what people's rights actually are to stand up. But the sense that you don't have rights, the sense that you're part of this chain of command, and if you, the perpetrator of abuse and violence is somebody above you, a senior person, a commander, and you have to follow them, and you will be disciplined simply for not following them, and then the idea that if you report them, they can do so much to destroy you. I mean, and this is an organization that is basically an organization of organized violence, where everyone is armed and able to deploy weapons. I mean, it seems to be like the perhaps one of the biggest problems, in addition to racism, that faces rank and file service members in the U.S. military.
Yeah, I mean, it was a struggle for women to get the right to serve in the military in the first place also. You know, as contradictory as that is, it was knowing what the U.S. military ends up doing and what women are subjected to once they're in. It was, you know, a center of equality struggle. for the women's movement. And, you know, like I remembering just personally, like in the early 2000s, right? I mean, I talked to at least two women who I was in training with who said when they were in basic training, they were sexually assaulted by the people who were over them, drill sergeants and other, you know, non-commissioned officers functioning there. And the idea was, you know, you couldn't do anything about it. Like, of course, you can't report your drill sergeant. Of course, you can't report the guy who was giving the penicillin shots. You know, when I was deployed, you know, I had a close friend, a young woman in my company who she would just say, like, I can't walk anywhere. And I need one of you to come with someone I trust to come with me to walk here, to walk there, to go get food, because she was fearful of going anywhere by herself. And so these are things that I think were just kind of really well known. But people like Hegg said that it's not just this idea that women are this huge problem in the military because you got to walk on eggshells and they're just accusing everyone of sexual assault and being uncomfortable. He doesn't like the fact that women are in the military at all. And so a lot of the reforms that he, and this is, you know, we've seen how they you know, try to blame women in leadership positions and in the military for various things. He thinks the military should be, you know, just men. And so in addition to saying sexual assault should not be able to be reported in the way it was and that you should be able to do or say whatever you want in the workplace and not get in trouble for it, he's also, you know, made a lot of reforms that deal with the physical fitness standards. He doesn't like that women were allowed in combat arms jobs. And so he's making it much more difficult for them to do those things. And again, these were changes that the Pentagon made, not because they had become woke or anti-sexist, but because they felt they needed to adapt to a changing society. And so, hey, if we say we have women in the infantry now and profile these women infantry officers, that's going to make us more appealing for people, you know, the best and the brightest of college students to want to join the army and all of that. And so these were measures that were never in good faith by the military, but just a necessity to continue recruiting people into something that had been declining in public perception for good reason over the years. But I do think that it's going to become an increasingly dangerous environment for lower ranking women in particular, working class women from around the country who go into the military as an escape from a lot of times from abusive situations, from poverty, and are going to end up in a very toxic situation again.
Mike, I want to talk to you about how other people in the U.S. ruling class are relating to this power grab by Trump, deploying the U.S. military into cities, talking about the Democratic Party like it's an extremist radical organization. And Stephen Miller uses this language. I mean, it, obviously very fascistic sort of trend within the administration. And, you know, the U.S. ruling class has different political factions, trends, and the same with the military. General Mark Milley, who was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff during the I believe he was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs during the first Trump administration. We have a clip from him. I want to play it. He's obviously disgusted with Trump. He represents another section within the military and another section within the ruling class that feels that Trump's power grab, the extreme right-wing orientation of the Trump administration, the racism, the sexism, it's actually going to hurt the position of U.S. capitalism, U.S. imperialism, and the U.S. system. So they have their own sort of reasons to be against Trump. And unfortunately, some people who rightfully don't like Trump, don't agree with the power grab, look to people like Mark Milley and say, well, look, we can fasten our political fortunes to his kite because he's somebody who has credibility. He's not an extreme radical, to put it mildly, like, and all that. Now, Mark Milley is an imperialist, but I want to play this clip because it does show that there is an inter-elite factional struggle, and it's not just coming from the right wing against the centrist wing of the ruling class, but the centrist wing, or at least some of them, want to fight back. Listen to this clip from Mark Milley.
We don't take an oath to a country. We don't take an oath to a tribe. We don't take an oath to a religion. We don't take an oath to a king or a queen or a tyrant or a dictator. And we don't take an oath to a wannabe dictator. We don't take an oath to an individual. We take an oath to the Constitution, and we take an oath to the idea that it's America, and we're willing to die to protect it.
So classic talk about, you know, their military is apolitical. It's defending the Constitution. The oath is to the Constitution, not to any political leader. Anyway, I want to get your thoughts. Like, how deep is the division within the military, the resistance? There's the division from the officer corps, the bourgeoisie in uniform, and then the opposition within the military from the rank and file soldier, service member, you know, the worker in uniform. And then just the your own take, because you're a careful analyst of what's going on in American society, about these the resistance within the ruling class to Trump's power grab.
I think Miley's speech is really an emblematic example of what we can expect from the generals, the leadership of the U.S. military. He gave a speech when he retired that mildly criticized Trump. When he was in and he was chairman of the Joint Chiefs under staff, it's reported that he did push back internally against Trump, wanting to deploy the military to shoot Black Lives Matter protesters, which is great. Very happy he did that. Trump, of course, punished him for that. You know, as soon as Trump took office, he had Miley's portrait taken down from the Pentagon, which was standard practice for all chairmen of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And so it was very obvious that he wanted to set an example. Hey, if you oppose what I'm telling you to do, I'm going to make sure that your legacy is not what it should be. But the idea that this room full of generals who were so insulted and outraged by the types of things that Hegseth and Trump in particular were saying is something we can have hope in, I think that's a little fantastical. I would say that there's probably some number of generals in that room who thought the speech was stupid. There were some who probably didn't like some of the changes, like some that were worried about the physical fitness standards on them that were being implemented that they didn't have to worry about before, that they would get upset about. But I think that, a lot of them probably liked this speech. I mean, there's this presentation that, you know, and even from Miley's speech, that their job is like defenders of the Constitution. And that is their job as military commanders, is upholding democratic and constitutional rights in America. That's not how generals see themselves. They are professional war fighters. That is their expertise. For them, that is their job. That is their profession, is fighting a war. Whether depending on which branch of it they're in, it's all about being effective as a killing machine. And so probably a lot of the reforms that Hegseth was talking about, attacking, women and minorities and gay people and the rule of law. I'm sure that was probably welcomed by a lot of the generals, because they thought, hey, these things are kind of getting in the way of our ability to do things. And I would rather just focus on my job than anything else. And so I think that we shouldn't expect that a lot of these people are like liberals and like really worried about what was being said. And if there are ones that were worried that didn't like what Trump was saying, do we think they're going to do anything about it? I say no. I mean, everyone in that room who was an officer in particular, there's senior enlisted there, but everyone there who was a four-star, three-star general, they're either a few months away or a couple years away from retiring with a really nice pension and then going and working on the board of directors of a weapons manufacturer, of an oil company, or of a financial firm. They would limit their options if they did anything that hurt their career on their way out. They are very close to a very cush life. And they see their jobs as, look, the letter that people should read from the Oregon commander to the troops deploying to Portland is very emblematic also. He's saying, I don't like this. I know you don't like this, but our job is to follow the orders of the president. And that is very much the ethos within the Pentagon establishment. They have a job. Their job is to run the military machine. They don't involve themselves in politics. And, they follow the orders of the president. And if they don't like a particular president, you know what? He's gone in 3 years and there's going to be another president. And they see their worldview as measured out, in decades forward, not just looking to the year forward. And so I don't think we should expect any opposition from that leadership class of the U.S. military. The opposition, the hope for opposition within the military will come from the rank and file, those privates and E4s and E5s and young officers who are being sent to these cities to do things that are clearly unconstitutional, that are clearly taking us closer and closer to a tyrannical police state, and things that are aimed at attacking immigrants and so who are our neighbors and our friends and so forth. And so that's really where the hope is. And I think anyone putting their eggs in the basket of, you know, that photo they were sharing of the generals looking all mad, which is pretty much what they always look like. You know, they have an image to maintain, that there's any kind of hope in the opposition from there. I don't think there's any precedent for that or any reason to think that we should be looking to them for as saviors in any capacity. I mean, who people think these guys are?
They're the
heads of the Pentagon.
Mike, as we move towards the end here, I want to stay with this theme of don't have any confidence in any general. Don't have confidence that there's going to be some significant pushback against Trump's right-wing, authoritarian, racist, sexist assault on basic democratic rights from within the establishment and especially from within the Pentagon. You, the Empire Files team, Abby Martin, you've come out with a new movie called Earth's Greatest Enemy about the Pentagon. So real quick, why the title? What's the theme? And what can people do to watch it or to promote it?
Yeah, sure. Well, you can go to earthsgreatestenemy.com to watch the trailer and learn more about the national tour we're on. U.S. military, biggest military in world history with the most expansive presence around the planet. People know, of course, that has an enormous human toll on the people who are killed and occupied. But it has a pretty big environmental toll that spans a lot of different sectors, from toxic waste dumping to carbon emissions to disruption of ocean life. And there has never been a piece of media, let alone a film, that covers that topic in its entirety. And that's what this documentary film is. And so right now you can only see it on a tour that we're going on, which you could find out about on the website. But soon it will be coming to other theaters and streaming services.
And real quick, before I let you go.
It's been a 4 or 5 year project. So excited for people to finally see it. And this other angle of the military that isn't often talked about. And I will say it does connect to what we're talking about today. Because when Trump's talking about using U.S. cities as training grounds, he's not just talking about using them as training grounds so that we can go and occupy places around the world. He's also talking about training for what's coming in the future of the United States. And they know, the Pentagon is aware that climate crisis is a real thing that is happening. It will be the cause for more unrest and so-called security issues within the United States. And they very much see the increased militarization of police and deployment of the military domestically to deal with those problems rather than trying to mitigate them or prepare for them in a real sustainable way.
Yeah, and I was starting to ask you, but I think you mentioned it. It's a 5 year long project.
Yes. Yeah, we started working on it in 2020 during the uprisings, and a lot's happened since then. But it's continues to be a developing story, of course. But I think as a little time capsule of where we're headed is important for people to see, and I think more importantly as a way to. You know, most people care about the planet and the environment, and this is an intervention to make people who care about the planet and the environment understand why they have to be opposed to militarism and imperialism as a way to save the planet and the life that they care about.
All right, and people can find a screening in a city or town near you by going to earthsgreatestenemy.com. Mike Preisner, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.